Did anybody here see the movie Singing in the Rain? Yes. You know the famous scene? Yes, no, 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 with the voice. Right. The movie was an excuse for all these production numbers, right, for dancing and singing numbers. But it sort of takes place. The movie is about the beginning of the talking movies, right? So this it has phenomenal tap dancing, to say the least. But it also has these hilarious scenes, right? We see the first microphones there's a scene, and every time the protagonist, this woman in the movie, turns her head around, you just hear, and now you can hear her. Back and forth. it's very, very funny. Okay, we need one more gizmo here. Maybe. Okay, so the spirit of this afternoon was to sort of understand a little bit what, if any, relevance all this, all these fancy models and things that got the statistical mechanicians all very, very excited has in relationship to biology. And I think what's probably, you know, it was clear from Misha's presentation, it's the flavor that you're working in the limit of a very large number of neurons, that you have patterns which are patterns in a statistical sense, that neurons can drop out of the pattern, come back into the pattern, and sort of the deep, I think the deep ideas and the deep tests of these ideas really have to do with perturbing the system and seeing if the system recovers after it's perturbed, which means maybe taking neurons out of the system and seeing, in fact, if the state is robust to these kind of perturbations. And that's a fair thing to think about experimentally. And so I'm gonna operate in kind of what's almost now a trivial limit with respect to these models, in the limit where you know n is like 2 or 3 or 4. So and talk about at least, you know, if certain features, you know, almost mechanical features of these models make sense. Like if the learning rule, like this kind of head type learning rule made sense in terms of the connections that you see. Okay, and or if the thresholds of the neurons, which Misha talked about, and how you need to adjust the threshold to make sure a neuron's operating region is really allows it to respond to the input, if these things really hold true. So it's a trivial limit in terms of testing these models, but it's still a useful exercise because it suggests how, at least for some systems, which I'll get to, these motor systems called central pattern generators, in fact, may follow this flavor dynamics that Misha talked about, you know, even though you're not probing, I would say, the deeper issues involved in these models. Okay, so I'm gonna, this is work that was done about 5,000 years ago, and there's a book chapter, so you could just, I'll leave it here to be copied, so just, keep me from running too many integrals on the board or any integrals on the board, so just sit back. Friday, Shabbat, just enjoy the show. Okay, so, you know, there's a set of completely disgusting and gruesome experiments that are done in biology, where you take an animal and you sever its spinal cord, and that you find the fact that the animal still works. Actually, maybe it's a metaphor for half the faculty in my department, but what happens is that these are called spinalized preparations, and they've been a medical model to understand spinal injury, but they've also been a model that have introduced the idea of the autonomous pattern generator, or what people call the central pattern generator, even though they're in the periphery. And one particularly model system came, this is work by Avis Cohn when she was a postdoc in Wallen's lab. And you can take like a dogfish or a lamprey. These are preparations that are, you know, have a spinal cord, mostly cartilaginous spinal cord, and you could suck on to a number of nerves. You've made an animal that's you've basically filleted this poor animal, right? You've taken its spinal cord out of the animal. You've eviscerated it, right? You've placed it in a dish and you've pinned it out, and yet you have the audacity to call this biology. And you take a number of electrodes with, and then just going to suck up the nerve, right? So you're listening to these roots, which are driving all. You know, in this case, you know, muscles in the body wall of the animal as it flexes and swims. And the amazing thing is that if you turn on, if you sort of adjust the thresholds of the cells by adding the right modulators, in this case, it's glutamate acting as a metabotrophic. It's just something receptor, just a receptor that's just sort of turning down the thresholds of the neuron. What you find, lo and behold, is that this poor little fillet of what was formerly a dogfish is actually sitting there, and these nerve roots are just firing, right? And they're firing with a pattern, okay, of you know, swim right, swim left, swim right, swim left, swim right, swim left, right? So you have to imagine that this animal is trying to escape the torture of its dish and trying to swim away because you've activated this pattern generator that exists in the spinal cord. And it's this is kind of a very general phenomena. This is this is data on turtle. It's actually the scratch reflex on turtle. And this comes from Paul Stein's lab at Washington University. And again, you create this so-called spinalized preparation of a turtle, and you tickle it under its arm, and it's just sitting there doing this, right? So there's this notion of a circuit that's working autonomously without feedback, okay? And this is sort of you can see that this already begins to smell a little bit of this flavor of circuitry that Misha spoke about. So he didn't talk about, except for some flavor of temporal dynamics and it arriving at a minima, right? You might think that this has a little bit of a flavor of the attractor dynamics, because you could look and there's this idea of a state where this nerve root is firing, and then it's quiet. So it's on, then off, then on, then off, then on, then off, right? This really has this kind of flavor of 0-1, okay? And you look at another root, and there's this notion of off, then on, then off, then on. And if you just stood here and drew little lines, you could sort of very nicely divide this into a series of states. And you, at least one approximation is then to think of this as sort of, you have a network with many states, and you're making transitions between states. So this is an idea, just kind of like culottes or something, sort of goes in and out of fashion in neuroscience, this idea of sort of the attractor hypothesis, and you're moving from attractor to attractor to attractor. But now what are culottes known as now? I don't know. My little daughter has a name for these things these days, but I realize it's exactly the same thing. I remember girls when I was her age. Yeah, yeah. Capris, yeah. It is spikes. These are extracellular recording, right? So you're... Yeah, because it's extracellular... What?
Something minus something.
No. What you're looking at here is, you know, the cell works by, you know, CdVdt plus, you know, GV is the sum of the currents, right? And you're outside the cell, and so you're asking what currents do you see, and if And if the events are very fast compared to the time constants of the cell, then I can forget about this term. And what I'm mostly seeing is just a displacement current term. Okay, and that has to integrate out to zero, okay, because charge is conserved. So the amount of stuff up has to equal the amount of stuff down if I'm outside the cell. Okay, and this, don't worry about this. It's okay. It's nice data. And so, okay, now the problem with it's really only now that people are beginning to record from sort of ganglia in the spinal cord and or in the brainstem that are responsible for some of these activities. I mean, it's only now that we're sort of getting some phenomenology about some of the central pattern generators that are responsible in mammals for things like walking or even things like breathing or twitching. But so there's not much to say about the circuitry there, but it was sort of a program that sort of started in the early 70s, right, to look at small critters. Okay, so the program had some success and some failure, and it's there's interesting sociology reasons for the failures, but okay, so this, I mean, okay, at the level of ITP, all ganglia are equal, okay? So I'm going to end up describing data from a number of critters just to give you a little bit of a flavor, but this is sort of a very interesting thing. You take an animal that has no shell or no bone structure, which basically defined neuroscience until about 15 years ago, and people, you know, started to get tools, right, to sort of look deep into tissue, maybe even 10 years ago. And what happened is you had sort of, you know, sort of a very repetitious, often very repetitious nervous system. This happens to be data from the leech. This is a picture from that Adam Taylor supplied me from Bill Kristan's lab. It's not important, but if you look down at the leech, you see individual neurons. Okay, these suckers are enormous. Some of these things are about 50 microns, and the joke is that when you desheath them, they actually have little letters on them and tell you exactly where you are, just like your roadmap. But this became a popular place to study because often a single ganglia was capable of producing rhythmic output, like I showed you earlier. And the point is, you get many of these, right? You do an experiment, and then there's another one, right? You do an experiment, and then there's another one. You do an experiment, and then there's another one. So it became kind of the ideal preparation to study. I still think it's the ideal preparation to study in many ways. And let me sort of give you the state of the art. This is data that comes from Al Silverstein's lab. Again, this was data that came out about the mid 80s. So I think this field kind of, this represents, in my mind, okay, I hope this guy's never on my review committee. It's okay, he has already rejected three of my papers, so I can say anything I want. this sort of was the peak activity of the field, okay? And it was kind of, in its day, it was a kind of tour de force. So this is data taken from the crab or the lobster, picked for obvious reasons that I won't mention. And what happens is that the stomach in this animal is run by a ganglion that contains radules or little teeth, right? It'll just sit there, right? Just grind, right? Churn away. And it was something to understand where this pattern generator came from. And it had other features that were interesting. It seemed that the same group of neurons were capable of two patterns. So the sort of experimental picture was a little bit richer. And depending how you count, there were something like 23 cells. It doesn't sound like many, but from an experimental point of view, you'd like, you know, if you were on a peg, one of these models, you want to be each of these sigma I's that Misha wrote on the board, is you'd like to have a little probe there, right? Know about each sigma I. So Al had, and still may have, kind of this world's record of surrounding his preparation with about, eight different Narshigi probes and sticking eight cells at once and recording from these cells at once. Okay, so here's the good news. Okay, so let's look at the top guy. Now, 23,000 is a lot, and even if you record from a third of them, it's still only a fraction of what's going on, particularly if there's a couple of patterns. So there was a very clever student of ours named John Miller, and there used to be, what's this guy, Stewart, right? Ozzie Stewart? Stewart? The guy who went on at the NIH to accuse everybody of plagiarism and eventually was booted out of the NIH because he didn't understand that you will have correlations if you have common source material. Okay, had one scientific claim, was he invented Lucifer Yellow. And Lucifer Yellow at his time was a fluorophore with the highest quantum yield, right, of any fluorescent dye. And people would just, you know, fill their pipette with this stuff and stick that sucker, and at the end of the experiment, it would just be glowing bright and take a picture of it, and they'd have like a picture of the cell that they had stuck and all its morphological glory. And it was quite an achievement. And John Miller one day actually tried to make a picture while he was recording, and he noticed very rapidly that the cell went dead, and this was the birth of a sort of powerful technique to inject cells and then wipe them out. Okay, so he was able to take the circuit with some 23 cells and basically whittle it down to things with the small of two cells. So it was a kind of very, very clever guy, sort of tour de force, and we can just sort of see what happens. And now we could get down to cases. So let's just look at the top line. There's two cells, VD and LP. It's in that part of this thing called the pyloric rhythm, and because they were able to poke these cells, they can measure the conductivity. So from experimentally, things are looking up, okay? Ooh. So this is two cells. Okay, so they measure J12 and J21, right? I'm not showing you that data, and they showed it had an inhibitory connection, right? So it begins to look a little bit like the picture Sebastian drew on the board of a circuit, flip-flop circuit, with reciprocal inhibition, right? And if we look further, what happened is by getting the circuit down, we can see this sort of interesting thing that one cell fired quite a bit, then another cell would blast off and fire quite a bit, then another cell would fire quite a bit. So I think what you could see is already now, it turns out the synapse in this particular cell, these synapses weren't static, sort of the way that Misha described this morning, but in fact they adapted out. And Misha's going to spend a lot of time tomorrow talking about synaptic depression and its impact on networks. So if you add one thing, which is that if you look at the J21 of T versus time, and this is when the cell is activated. Okay. Then the synapse would start to fatigue out over time. Okay, so then this neuron is firing. It's holding this neuron in the off state. Okay, but this connection begins to fatigue versus time. Then this neuron can start to fire. When it starts to fire, it inhibits and turns off this neuron. So this thing is just going flip-flop, flip-flop, flip-flop. So if there's any, I mean, in a sense, this one figure summarizes what I would say is all the hard knowledge of the field in central pattern generators, right? It's the idea that things are going flip-flop by some number of mechanisms. And I'll sketch like two or three of these, okay? And it's sort of trivial here. There's some reciprocal circuit, I wouldn't call it recurrent, with two, and you've had to add some feature, some sort of temporal dynamics, okay? In this case, it happens to be synapses. John Miller and Al Silverstein went on. They made a circuit with three cells. It's interesting again to look at the data. It looks like two reciprocal circuits. It's almost a, you know, in retrospect, it's almost a trivial extension. These guys have a resistor between them. That doesn't mean they went down to Radio Shack and got an Allen Bradley resistor. It really means that there was some electrical connection between the cell, and it was sufficiently strong that these guys tended to be synchronized, okay, pretty much. And well, but then you say, great, what a program. And they started looking at more complicated circuits with five different cells or six different cells. Okay, So sort of the edge of understanding ended there in about 1985 and has not been improved since. Part of what happened is that subsequent to this work, one of the students from the Silverson group, Eve Motter, and one of the students from a competing group, Ron Harris Warwick, went off and showed that these modulators, okay, the fact that when the, if you go to a lobster tank at Bonds or something, Ralph's, right? You know, there's always one lobster that's up there, right, towering over all the other lobsters, and the other lobsters are cowered down, right? But this is really a case of drugs make the man, right? Because the one that's up, hunched over, is just pumped up with serotonin, and that becomes the dominant animal. And this was shown very nicely by Margaret Livingstone in her thesis. With Ed Kravitz, where she took a lobster and she just pumped that sucker up with serotonin and got up at its haunches and it became the king of the fish tank, but the consequence here is that these are actually cells taken out of the animal, and this was sort of a real case where we're taking the neurons out of the animal, okay. Somehow change their properties because you needed to know what the modulation level is. Okay, so this is sort of a warning for everybody. I think that this whole issue was brought very nicely into the field of mammalian physiology by David McCormick and David Prince and among others, right? There are certain properties of neurons that, particularly their threshold levels and the gain of the slope of their gain curves, which will change dramatically depending on sort of the level of other chemicals that act very slowly in the nervous system, right? So from the point of view of modeling, you can think of a state being kind of constant, right? But I think this was the first evidence where sort of a research program collapsed. And I think if you take the connections that were measured in this case and take the kind of patterns that were found, you find they're completely inconsistent. And I'll show you how a prescription lies. Okay, so this is, we're sort of at the level of twosies, okay? You know, there's a whole lot of examples of this, just so I could justify my statement that the field is at the level of twosies. This is data from Ron Calabrese. This is respiratory pumping in the leech. The leech doesn't really have a heart. It has a tube, and there's a little wave of contraction that goes along this tube, and the blood just gets pushed out, you know, sort of like if you had to grab a balloon at one end and keep going like this. And again, you find two neurons, these are heart neurons, three, again, reciprocal inhibition, additional temporal dynamics, okay. And then there's just a kind of interesting example I just wanted to show you. This was, I thought, really one of the more beautiful papers, experimental papers I've read. This is by Richard Satterley, who also happens to be a fantastic softball player. And Richard studied this animal called Cleona. It's this small animal that swims close to the surface of water. And what he found were two cells, okay, that make reciprocal inhibitory connections. And unlike the previous cases where things are just bursting like crazy, this guy is literally playing ping pong with a spike. Spike, right, comes into one cell, turns that cell off. Okay, and then there's sort of an additional feature, it was actually a prediction before it was found, that comes out of the Hodgkin-Huxley model, that when that cell actually rises up from its inhibition, it fires a spike. Okay, and it's called post-inhibitory rebound. Okay, now let me just sketch it, because I just sort of use this time just to sketch some of the sort of nonlinearities that could happen. What happens in the Hodgkin-Huxley model, as a function of voltage, you have I told you there was this inactivation curve, okay? And so the probability of being, and here's the resting voltage, okay? So you're sitting here, and there's a certain amount of probability that you've lost some number of channels, right? Because they've turned themselves on, Okay, you can see this with an individual neuron. This is kind of, you reach threshold, you'll reach a lower threshold if you try to depolarize the cell faster. Okay, this is kind of interesting phenomenon. So the cell is sitting towards rest. Okay, remember we talked about the Hodgkin-Huxley current. We should use sigma, so I'll use G. And here is the spike, and the current came up quickly, maybe not so quickly. This is activation. All right, and we had some other curve. I'm drawing these backwards from the usual way they're in textbooks, but it doesn't matter. I mean, the activation curve is very, very close to the inactivation curve. And the point is that we get about here. This is the threshold for firing. But this is fast kinetics, and this is slow kinetics. So what happens is the cell sort of activates, and then I said this channel very slowly inactivates over time. Okay, so there's this interesting effect that if you were normally sitting here, then I put a synapse in that hyperpolarizes the cell. Okay, this is this, then all of a sudden I'm no longer okay on this inactivation curve. So I get back my full complement of current, right? All my sodium channels are ready to go. Okay, then if I very rapidly come back to this level, what'll happen is I can hit this threshold level with all my receptors ready to go. And you could actually get a case where you turn the cell off, then it comes back on very quickly and fires a spike, and then goes back to its steady state of being off. Okay, so this little animal is just swimming, and it's driven by single spikes. Okay, so the point I'm trying to make here is that we have the same circuitry. It's two cells hooked up by reciprocal inhibition, this reoccurring theme. Okay, that's sort of the one constant of the motion, anything that oscillates. And there's just sort of a whole smorgasbord of temporal dynamics ranging from cells that fatigue out, I mean, synapses that fatigue out, to sort of basic sort of Hodgkin-Huxley phenomena with post-inhibitory rebound that causes it to fire. Maybe I should point out here what I'm talking about, okay? This is DU. I fire D, I look in U, I get a little inhibition, right? That I fire U, I look in D, I get a little inhibition. That's the reciprocal inhibition. And what's happening here is that I'm just sitting in this particular case is I sit in D and I inhibit the cell with an electrode, right? Pump negative current very briefly into it at this point, and then let go, and the cell just rebounds, fires a spike, and goes off, and then it doesn't fire another spike. So this is this reciprocal inhibition. And if I just look at the cell firing on its own, in fact, you get spike, 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 spike. This is an epoch where Dick injected current into the second cell, kept the cell from firing. Okay, so it kept the U cell from firing. Now the U cell is not giving any inhibitory input now to the D cell. The D cell goes quiet. Right, so it's a funny system, right? You turn once, you know, you fire your neighbor by first turning it off, and if the thresholds are all adjusted just ever so carefully, you'll actually get a spike. Okay, so just many different kinds of temporal dynamics in a circuit with reciprocal inhibition can lead to this game of alternating motion. Okay, so that's, you're now state-of-the-art experts on CPGs. Okay. Okay, now, that said, we're going to look at one particular central pattern generator that had some inspiration on Hyacinth Polinsky and myself, and it actually looks like we can take a little extension of what Misha talked about with adding a second set of connections. Okay, so Misha talked about the original sort of Hebril connections in the Hopfield model, which were these. Okay, so these connections try to keep you in a certain fixed point. Okay, so you can almost view them as a projection operator, right? If you came in with a certain state, okay, then and you had your connections hooked up as Misha described. Okay, then this would try to take you back to the same state. Okay, and but then Misha talked about some additional connections. Okay, of the form where it connected you between states, and you could see that these sort of have the beginning of what you would need to generate sort of patterns, because you have some set of connections which are stabilizing. And it could be that for appropriate values of A and some temporal dynamics I haven't talked about yet, then you could have some connections like this that in a sense are sort of mapping you from state to state. Because you're starting in, say, the new minus one state, and then if these somehow dominated, right, by this same argument, they would take you into the new state. So you could see how you could build a little rule that'll take you from state to state to state. Okay, so you just have to add a little bit to flesh it out. Okay, so before we break down into any more math, let me just sort of describe this little critter. It's a critter that you can actually see these off of the. These things actually live in Puget Sound. It's called a Tritonia. It's a nudibranch. It's sort of an excellent model for human existence. It comes up to another nudibranch if it recognizes it as the same species. It tries to mate. If it recognizes a different species, it tries to eat it. Vicious little world, but you know, every animal has its predator, and the predator for this is the starfish. And what will happen is that if a starfish comes and tries to tinkle this Tritonia, and you could fake this by dropping a little salt on one of these guys in the fish tank, it'll retract, okay, and then it goes through this escape rhythm, right? Where it'll sort of contracts. It's a very stereotypic movement at first. It's going from elongation to contraction, and then it just sits there. And I mean, this is called swimming, but I mean, we're not exactly talking butterfly stroke here. I mean, this little guy just goes flip flop, flip flop, flip flop, right? And it tries to get a little hydrodynamic lift. And Puget Sound, for those of you who haven't been there, is, you know, that the current runs fast. So, you know, a little bit of lift, it's moving downstream. And the starfish are not very social, so it's not like there's another starfish downstream waiting for the Tritonia to politely, you know, fall into its lap. Okay, they're not quite like vultures, okay? So it has this escape rhythm, and again, it seems it's very sort of two-state system. Now, Dennis Willows is a physiologist up at University of Washington at Friday Harbor, who studied the circuitry. And in particular, it was a student of his, Peter Getting, who really shook out a lot of details. And I just want to sort of briefly go through this exercise, which is basically a consistency argument using sort of small extension of what Misha described this morning, just to say that you really can do things by hand within the framework of the sort of Hopfield model. So what Peter had done was he identified 12 neurons involved in the swim rhythm. Now, the animal has, except for starfish, right, that have 5 feet, right, virtually everything has a symmetry. I guess he cut it right. Even a starfish has a symmetry axis, okay? And so he got down to 6 neurons, and then it turns out that these guys, the dorsal swim neurons, there are 3 of them, and they're stuck together with very strong electrical connections. So by the time you get down to it, you have 4 neurons, all right? So the first thing you're thinking, well, this guy's just going, okay, and other critters are doing this with 2 neurons, and this guy takes 4 neurons. So I want to think a little bit, why, what I get out of this redundancy, right? I got to get something out of this redundancy. But what Peter did is he recorded from all 6 of these at once. This is truly typical best, and See, these two guys, I mean, talk about being a theorist in the mid-80s. I mean, you just look at this guy. It's on, it's off, it's on, it's on, it's just crying. It's just, it says, you know, I am a spin, right? It's on, off, on, off. Okay, same thing here with the dorsal swim interneuron. And then there's sort of a second set of on-off that's shown here. On, off, on, off. Okay, so it's not perfect, but it kind of has a flavor. So, I mean, one's very tempted to think of explaining this in terms of two states, in sort of in Nietzsche's notation, sort of sigma one is a one, sigma two is a one, sigma three is a minus one, sigma four is a minus one, and then there's a flip state, which of course is just exact opposite, right? Sigma, the other state is minus one plus, plus one plus one, okay, and so you have this little guy that runs with two states, okay, or it's sort of trivial, one state and it's complement, right? So that was the first thing that kind of caught people's eyes, and then there was a second thing that kind of caught people's eyes, and it gets back to a little bit of synaptic dynamics, and I'm doing this in terms of the biology. I mean, historically, of course, the model came before the biology, but I've had enough models today. Let's worry about the biology. So Peter did another set of experiments, and you know, yesterday Sebastian talked a little bit about Bard's method of averaging, where the slowest time scale in the system is really the synapse, okay? And that means that some synaptic time scale is slower than even the membrane time constant, the integration of the voltage. And it's likely that you see that in mammalian systems during high levels of activity, there's one brand of excitatory receptor, the NMDA receptor, that gets turned on. And the off rate for the neurotransmitter is about 150 milliseconds or so. And so it's very, very slow, right? So that sort of, I think Bard's idea is kind of right on the money. And in these guys, you're really in the same limit because the synapses are slow, and not only are they slow, but they occur on two timescales. And if you remember, I said something like every time we've looked in systems, there's been some temporal dynamics that have had to get put in to make it oscillate between states. And this was an interesting case because, again, just kind of typical best data from Peter's lab. You're recording from the dorsal swim interneuron, you're exciting cerebral cell 2, you put this blast of action potentials into cerebral cell 2, it's an invertebrate, nothing subtle going on here, and you look in dorsal swim interneuron 2, and first what you see is an excitatory response and inhibitory response. So that's the first thing, okay, so it seems like life's a little more complicated because you have two types of receptors, but it's not just that the sign is changing. The real critical issue is that this little guy is fast somehow, right? This guy came up quickly, and when the bursts went away, it's hard. It's convoluted with this other time constant. But basically, the fast one, the excitatory one, dies quickly, and then there's this inhibitory one that seems to be very, very long lived. So at least in this case, you have this idea that you could characterize, so all of the JIJ are all known, and more so that the JIJ are really functions of time. Okay, so we want to think a little bit, and let's just capitalize on this scheme. Okay, so that's just, I'm going to show you the data. So let me just sketch a little extension of what Misha talked about previously to see how we could use this. Okay, I want to keep this. Okay. So you have the following idea. You can view the synaptic connections in sort of Hopfield scheme, these connections, right? As state, this is like a stabilizing map, right? You're in, it's like projection operating, quantum mechanics, except it takes you from where you are, right? It takes you from the state you're in and maps you back to that state, right? So if I come in now with my new state, and this happens to be one of the +1, +1, -1, -1 states, what's this guy going to do? It's just going to give me back one of those states, right? It's kind of stabilizing. That's what this guy does. It's kind of stabilizing, right? Now this guy is kind of destabilizing. Okay, someone asked before what the effect of having sort of not asymmetric matrix, right? So, you know, at the level of four neurons, this is completely asymmetric matrix. But again, you could kind of look at it as something that takes you from the state you're in and maps you to the next state. Okay, so if you happen to just construct this, right, that this is one of the states was taking you to the next state. So let's see what's happening. This guy, so this is where the present state. Okay, so what's this doing? This just sort of acts on the present state. Okay, and then this just puts you in, so it takes you from your present state and then causes you to flip. Right? So we kind of see half the elements here, right? We see a set of connections which want to cause transitions, right? And a set of connections that want to hold you where they are. Now, the problem, in Misha's model, you know, A in some sense was sufficiently small that it biased the composition of the states. Okay, so every time you updated a memory, there was some correlation between one memory and the next. But if as Misha mentioned, if A became very, very large, right, so that in fact you could completely forgot about this symmetric term, right? In principle, the system could just drift and there would be no stable states. Okay, so we need to add something by hand, right? And we need to add by hand is this idea of two time scales. So we sort of saw this in the biology. And we need to put this in here. So what we want to do is we want to associate these guys, these stabilizing guys, with synapses that act fast. So you get into a state and I think this data kind of summarizes what you sort of, somebody smells this kind of adiabatic approach coming on slowly, and they, I don't know, they get a free hamburger at the next barbecue, okay. Then, there's this idea of sort of fast synapses, right? So you have a set of connections that very quickly try to hold you in a state, right? And then, if in fact, on some longer time scale, you have these stabilizing connections, you sort of have this interesting picture. You can sort of have this energy picture that Misha described where you have stability on the short term, right? And then this Hamiltonian is just this minima is slowly disappearing, okay? So we want to have these, we want these to act either in a slow way or equivalently, at least at the level of this model, in a delayed way. Okay, so that's the flavor of the model. So let's just see what that would look like. Okay, so I would have, I want to make one set of connections, which I'll call the stabilizing guys, some scale over n. Well, okay, new. Okay, 2, right? P is 2. I mean, talk about small p, right? Okay, and this would be, zeta 1 I, zeta 1 j, where I've identified the state. How do you draw these zetas, Misha? Okay, and then zeta, well, if that's 1, I'm going to make this guy 2. All right, so this is pretty obvious. Okay? And then I'll just define another set. Again, what I'll call the long-acting set, okay, which is, again, looks just like this, and very much like one of the terms that Misha put in his model to keep correlations, except this is just taking me to the next state. Okay, and again, it's mu equals 1 to 2. Okay, so now I have to start putting in additional stuff by hand to make it work. So I got to put in two additional things by hand if I hope to actually get transitions out of this kind of hot field-like model. Okay, so the one is, I mean, again, in sort of analogy with what Misha is, I need some scale between these two sets of connections. And I think in Misha's case, that he had a scaling factor A that had to be less than a half. Yeah, okay, what? More than a half, right? So, okay, I'll just also put an A here. Okay, and you can kind of see what happens. If A is very, very tiny, you know, if A is very small compared to 1, you know, why did I bother, right? But if A is very, very big compared to 1, this, I'm going to ignore these connections. So I'm probably going to want these connections on about the same strength. So going into this problem, I'm going to want A, which is a scale sort of order 1, right? Now, the second thing is I need some sense of dynamics. So we, again, you had, what did you use for the thing that's sigma axon? Sigma versus the input. That's the field. Okay, fine. Okay. Okay, so we had a set of equations that looked like H sub I. Okay, that's fine. H of I dot plus H of I equals, now the sum of two terms. So one is going to be the sum of Jij and whatever state the system is in. Just make sure, all right, obviously there's a time derivative. It's a function of time. And these are the stabilizing guys. So right now I've just written down the Hopfield model, right? And this will just hold the system in these states, okay? These are sort of trivially orthogonal, okay? And then what I need to do is I need to add to this a second term, which are these long connections. And then rather than have this act directly on the state itself, I need to have this act on some smoothed out version, right? So this is sort of the averaged or time-delayed version. Okay, and just to be specific about this, I just define this guy as just the present state of t minus, say, t prime. The usual thing, you don't want to use W because W is a weight. Okay, well, I'll pretend I'm Larry Abbott. Make it a K. Okay, and this is right, okay? Right, this is true. Okay, good. And this is just some weight. Okay, and what does this mean? It means that we've added now two things. So the first is A. This is the first thing we've added. And now we've added sort of this smooth version or time-delayed version. This is the second thing we've added by hand. And in particular, if we, say, look at this weight with a K, okay, as a function of time, it's just, you know, it could be something with a bump that's characterized by some delay time. And the most trivial version of this, of course, is to just think that this is just some delta function. Okay, now, Rune, I could write a delta function because it's inside the integral. Okay, so this just becomes sort of the time-delayed version of the state itself. Okay, so at this point, you could almost see how the dynamics would evolve in an almost trivial way, because what's happening on a short time, I'm saying, okay, these connections want to keep me in the state that I'm in, and they're sort of acting on the state that I'm in. These connections want to move me to a new state, but this is not the state I'm in, this is the previous state, right? Okay, because it's a state that's delayed by time tau. Okay, I could, and just make that a little explicit. So if we look sort of just after a transition into a state, okay, what does this look like? This guy is just acting on the state that I'm in. So let's say I just got into the first state. Okay, so this guy has terms that look like zeta 1, zeta j, zeta I 1, and I'm acting on the state, I just got into state 1, okay, plus zeta I, zeta j, zeta 2. This one I could forget about, so this term is sort of keeping me in this state. Okay, but now I look at this guy, and what's this going? This has terms that look like it's taking me from state 1 to state 2 if I'm going 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, right? And this is an A in front to get the scaling right. Okay, and then it's state 2 taking me into state 1. Now look, I just made a transition. So I'm sorry. This is 2, 2, 1 in this notation. Okay, so I just got into state 1. So my delayed version keeps me in the old state, which is 2. So this guy dies away. This is I'm just summing over j, 2 against 2. So this one wants to keep me in state 1, right? Because it's looking at the past. Okay. Finally, after a time TL, your past catches up with you, so to speak, for bad jokes on Friday afternoon. And this guy has stayed the same, okay, so nothing's happened here. But now let's look at what's happened here. Okay, this term again looks like the same, zeta 1, zeta 2, plus zeta 2, zeta 1. And now the delayed state is the state I'm in. All right. So this one now wants to try to put me into state 2. And you can see that if A is bigger than 1, I'll make a transition. Okay. So another, that's basically the idea here. And if you must, you could draw like Misha did, a little energy surface. And then you're say here, and this, in the limit that the slow connection is very, very slow. I still don't know what these pictures mean, but the chemists love them, right? This well is slowly disappearing. Okay, I'm still saying state 1. I'm still in state 1, even though underneath, right, my dynamics is changing, right? So I'm getting all the synaptic input built up from this, from these slow synapses, and finally, I get to the point where I make a transition. Okay, so the transitions are fast. They occur in this fast time scale. And again, if you remember from the thing that motivated us in this kind of data, and in general, from any of the CPG data that we looked at, the time between states is quick. I mean, one neuron doesn't hang around. It just turns off or goes to a new level and stays there. So the transitions are fast, but the states live long. Okay, so that was that's this basic idea. Okay, so it's very, very brute force. We're putting in by hand this sort of separation of time scales, right? And we put in by hand here, as Misha did, this kind of learning rule. Okay, so there's a couple more details, but we'll skip them and let's it's like car talk when they ask somebody to come back on the radio. Let's see how we did, okay? guess everybody's not from the States, right? You know. Who listens to Car Talk? Okay. It's a great show. Okay, so let's just take a look. So, all right, let's just keep in mind what's going on here. We got we have four different cells, right? So that means we have four choose two or six, right? Different connections between these cells. So we have to compute six numbers, okay, for the fast times and six numbers for the slow time, for the slow connections. We've defined the states as plus one, minus one, minus one. Okay, just plug away. And let's see what you got. Okay, now the thing about the theory, of course, in this Hebril is, I mean, Misha talked a little bit about dilution, but in fact, what you calculate is every possible synapse, right? And I'll explain in a moment what the impact is if you actually dilute. There was Misha's CIJ, dilution factor, on the board. But the bottom line is that you calculate this little matrix. This is the JIJ matrix, okay? And you calculate this other matrix for against the delayed connections. And then what you do is you go back to Peter's data, and you go through the original papers, which are not exactly the same as the review papers, and you measure exactly what he found for the sign of the synapse. So we're really brutalizing. I mean, these guys measure the synapses, you know, kind of carefully, and we're not paying attention if it's conductance or voltage or whatever. But what you find is that every synapse that you predict using this Hebril for this little system with four neurons matches up with what's seen experimentally. Okay, and you see this for both the fast-acting synapses and the slow synapses. But then there's this caveat. Okay, and the caveat is that there's a lot of guys missing. Okay. The caveat is that there are just synapses that aren't present. Okay, so this is something you can, you know, from a theoretical point of view, you can never. All you can say is this is one of a possible set. Sort of was you know, in sort of as Sebastian explained, that you can write down all permissible sets. Okay, so I'm writing down one set, which is the complete set. Okay, now what's the consequences? Different guys. Missing. And again, you could, as Sebastian explained, enumerate, okay, all possible permissible sets, okay, which is one thing to do. And one of those permissible sets will be the experimental data. But there's also a slightly maybe not as general way to do it, which is to say, okay, that's cool, everything matches, but I really haven't shown you the dynamics yet, right? And the flavor of this dynamics is that it's somewhat fault-tolerant. So maybe all the connections aren't there. So that means as the system, first I have to take these set of connections and these set of connections and show you that indeed the system is stable. Now we're talking 4x4 matrices here. We're not talking MATLAB or high math, right? So we could just do the linear algebra ourselves. And then I also have to say, let me just, again, go ahead and show that I could really get a transition. Okay, and the one thing you might suspect is that, well, if I'm missing a lot of connections, this is going to put a claim on this amplitude factor, this A factor, that I lost some connections, so I have to weight the remaining connections even more. Okay, so let's see if we could get some self-consistency going. So I'm just going to... okay, this is historical, and I'm sorry it's all written in terms of T's. Okay, a physicist, J, is a chemist, T is a computational, X's, W, okay? And since no biology journal would deal with neurons that had minus one for being off, it's written in terms of variable, which is 0, 1. But this is all meaningless stuff. And the bottom line is that if you take this measured matrix, okay, for the connection strengths, whose non-zero elements agreed with the theory, and you take this measured matrix for the long-term connections, and you just turn the crank, what you find is that for any value of A, that the system is indeed stable. So this was a small triumph. And then, in fact, if you go ahead a little further, what you find is that now you ask if you could have transitions. So you play the same game I showed on the board, right? You use just a pure time delay. So this is the most brutal form of algebra you could do, right? So now the past state is now the present state. And again, you take these matrices, and you just do matrix multiplication. And what you find is that you do, in fact, make a transition, but this amplitude factor, Miesch's A, okay, has to be bigger than a certain number. Okay, so I have one more thing to come to grips with. I have to understand if that is consistent with the data, right? So it's really sort of consistency check. And in fact, where does this A turn its ugly head? So we only get transitions if A is greater than 3. Okay, but now what you might see from looking back at the model is that the speed that this thing operates, okay, is going to depend on this coupling A. So you could actually do a calculation that nobody except your mother would care about and actually calculate the speed analytically. But it's you could kind of see what's going on, maybe. The bigger the long, as long as the time scale stays separated, right, as long as you maintain that the time scales stay separated, then the larger you make A, the more influence these transition-causing synapses have. Now, in a case with a pure delta function time delay, it doesn't matter how big you make it, because, I mean, basically you wait until this time, tau long, and then that's it. I mean, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen there. But if you come up with something, you know, more reasonable, whatever that means, okay, in biology, anything that's smooth and bumpy is more reasonable, okay, then you can imagine that the bigger this A, then you know, you only have to wait shorter and shorter times until the transition occurs. And, okay, at this point, you put in a bump and you play this game. So again, we're talking about simulating here four neurons. It's not that difficult. It works. It doesn't really prove anything because you already saw that it works on the blackboard. But if you put in again, just guided by the data, I mean, just put in some kind of bump that looks like that, right? All bumps in biology look like t e to the minus t. What you find, in fact, is that you find out that you need a trend in order to get sort of a periodicity, which is on the order of what's seen in the animal. You need this factor of A to be somewhere between 5 and 10. I mean, very, very qualitatively. And I think the flip that you could see is that if you go back and look at data like this, you can see somehow that the amount of area, the amount of charge that's being dumped into the slow-acting synapse is much, much greater than in the fast-acting synapse. Okay, so whether it's a factor of 5 or 10 or 15 bigger, I wouldn't argue. But you could at least qualitatively, you can see that the slow synapses, the long-acting synapses, are much greater in amplitude. And so you have the self-consistent story, right? So to sort of recap, I mean, you have a simple model in which you use a HEB or a modified like HEB learning rule. Okay, you put in by hand that the modification is a mapping from state to state. You put in by hand that you need some slow dynamics, which in this case is buried into the form of the synapses. You take this, you kind of predict the connectivity that you see. Again, it's 4x4. You could be happy for a little while. You could claim success, okay? And then you put a little bit of biological realism back in because you don't know which of the permissible set of connections are really there a priori. And then you could turn the crank and you could get some self-consistency between the relative amplitude of these sort of mapping versus non-mapping terms with the speed of the animal. Okay, there are a few other little things that came out, but that's kind of the gist of it. So I think that this kind of approach, it'd be great to take this kind of approach on something a little bigger, okay, where, and, but there's also a couple of things that you could see from here that Udi is really going to pick on in talking about stability and relaxation. You could ask now, why four or why six? Why not two? And okay, and then I think the reason is the following. Now, there's another thing that has to do with the threshold levels of the cell, and again, the self-consistency that way, which I'm not going to discuss, but you have this relationship between H sub i, which is the input, and sigma sub i, which is the output. Okay, and it, you know, in the particular example that was done by hand, of course, this was taken in the most brutal limit. But I think the important point is whether it's this curve or you know, even something unbound with no upper bound, like Sebastian talked about. It's this issue that Misha spoke about, that you really need to choose this threshold judiciously, okay? Because the inputs to the neuron have to be such that when you're in the sort of in the low state of input, you're here, and when the inputs are in their high state, that you're here. So the neuron is really swinging across this region, okay? And then the threshold level needs to be adjusted, so you're swinging across this region. I mean, this was particularly important in Misha's work on the dilute network, that you had to go back, and for proper adjustment of this threshold level, all of a sudden these sparse networks became extremely efficient. And what you see in words, in what the redundancy buys you in this case, okay, is that you have extra inputs to each neuron. So you have an operating region, which is really swinging like this. Okay, so it actually raises some interesting experimental questions, because, you know, you could have an operating region which is, as one sees sometimes in other systems, which is not quite symmetric. Okay, so it allows you a certain slop in the threshold. So you could certainly think of going into the lab and knocking out cells, okay, and knocking out cells is going to change the size of this band, and at the same time you could judiciously adjust the threshold levels by injecting current into the cell to make yourself symmetric. So this kind of game has, except for some small culture systems, this kind of game has not really been played, and it's a little bit of sort of a test of at least one aspect of these ideas. And I think in the case of tritonia, it illustrates a little bit of why, you know, I mean, it's tritonia, right? It's not doing field theory, and it's, you know, it's spending like 12 cells to do what other animals use 2 cells for. And I think what it's buying itself in part is this extra extra band. Okay, so this is more squishies than you need to know. Okay. So do you want to take a break, or Udi, do you want to? Okay, Udi is not here. We will take a break until 4 o'clock, and then Udi Zahari is going to talk more about the experiments and kind of data on perturbations in these kind of match after delay experiments that Misha started to speak about.